In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Wednesday, June 26, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Today on Pentagon Solutions, a close look at energy inside the Pentagon. Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, is my guest in studio. And, Madam Secretary, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Francis. It's a delight to be here.
Thank you for your time. And I want to start first by telling me about the mission of your office. It's a relatively new addition to the portfolio at the Pentagon.
It is a new office. It's just almost exactly 3 years old. And our mission is to improve the energy security of military operations. So what that means is we've got men and women deployed all over the world conducting a variety of missions, everything from combat to cybersecurity to humanitarian and disaster relief, and it takes a lot of energy to conduct those missions. So the mission of the office is to make sure that they have what they need, and there are three basic ways that we've been looking at getting there. One is use less, so control the demand. We have a marvelously capable force, but they need a lot of energy. So the energy we don't use is the best of all. Secondly, we want to diversify our supply. We want to make sure we have a lot of options and that we're looking at the security of that supply. And then finally, the third way we're going to get there is by building energy security into the future force. So all the ways that we build the force we need for the future, we want to make sure that energy is taken into account.
Now, let's take each of those individually, but I'll go backwards. The first one, building energy security into the future force. That sounds like the kind of thing that you might find especially challenging in the current budget environment that you're in right now.
Well, to be honest, everything's challenging in the current budget environment, least of which is building a brand new office, by the way. We are having to deal with that as part of the backdrop. On the other hand, the department, no matter what our budget environment is, the department is going to be building a force to protect the country. So the question then becomes, in what you are doing, you know, what you are organizing, training, and equipping, which is the mission of the whole department, how are you incorporating energy into that? So that's when what we're doing now is we're looking at things like strategic planning, war gaming, the requirements process, which is how the department decides what it needs, and then the procurement and acquisition process. And we're bringing energy into all of those things and incorporating them.
Now, you're at the beginning, you and your colleagues are at the beginning of the Quadrennial Defense Review process for 2014. What do you foresee being your office's role and the role of energy security overall in that planning process for the finished product that we see next year?
Well, we're working very closely with the offices that have the lead or the pen on the Quadrennial Defense Review to incorporate energy in. And it's certainly important to keep in mind that energy security and climate change were in the last Quadrennial Defense Review mentioned throughout as an important factor for the department to take into account. And in fact, it really helped define what my office does. You know, that and the fact that we had deployed forces who were asking us for a way to use energy better. It was really the last Quadrennial Defense Review and the demand signal from our deployed forces that led to the creation of my office. So we expect to be involved throughout the process.
I want to talk about the demand issue in a minute, but the middle item that you mentioned, diversifying the supply and ensuring its security. I imagine most folks, when they think about supply diversification, think about alternative or renewable fuels. But is that the only way that you're focusing on diversification, or are there other ways that that happens too?
There are a number of ways to look at diversification, but maybe one of the best ways for me to explain it is by giving you an example from our current operations. So in Afghanistan, which, you know, in the initial operations of my office, one of the things we've really tried to focus on is rapid fielding of new technologies and new practices to where we need it most. And Afghanistan is clearly one of those places. Diversification there has meant tactical solar. So we have these very remote bases where it's difficult to get supplies to, and anybody who's carrying fuel to them, whether they're doing it on the ground or in the air, is taking on a lot of risk, and it also means there's other missions they're not doing. So at the same time, those folks in the remote location really need their fuel. They can't operate without it. So we've been looking at the role of solar in cutting their fuel demand so that they can run their computers, their communications gear without relying on that supply line. So that's a diversification that's being driven by a military need. That's one of the things that we mean. We also mean we want to look at the security of our supply. So, in fact, I was just on a conference call this morning with U.S. forces in Afghanistan, and that was one of the issues that was coming up at a particular location, that we wanted to make sure, since all of the electricity they use on a base in a place like that is coming from a diesel generator and from petroleum, we wanted to make sure that the fuel supply and then the electricity from the generator to this one really important mission, that it was all secure and reliable. Because if that electricity supply goes down, it means that your folks on the ground don't have communications. So, you know, that's also what we mean by securing and diversifying our supply.
How much of the effort that you're doing there is the actual execution of strategy, and how much of it is kind of worldview shifting in that, for the example that you just gave, well, generators have been powered by petroleum since there have been generators, and that's just the way we do it. And if there's one kind of, I guess it's a misconception, but that's, I hear a lot about the Pentagon, it's we always do things because that's the way we always do things. And so you're trying to break that mold, fair or not, as that characterization may be.
I think it's a fair characterization that people are busy, and that when you're talking about war fighting, lives are at stake. And so there's a very powerful pull to do what you know works. You know, in this case, though, I think also you can point out that a lot has changed. We have a lot of new capabilities, high-end, you know, high-tech capabilities that are really impressive and that give our men and women in uniform, you know, they can do things they could never do before, even just down at the individual level. You know, they'll have night vision and they'll have a scope and they'll have GPS. It's amazing to think about what kind of capability just an individual on the battlefield has that they didn't have 5 years ago, 3 years ago. But it all requires batteries and fuel. So our fuel demand and our battery demand has gone up astronomically. So that's one thing that's different. So we have to change the way we do business. The other is the kind of battles we're in, where there is no front line to stay behind. Everything's on the battlefield. All of our supplies, all of it's in play, and it is targeted by our adversaries. These are things that have changed, so we have to change too. And better energy security is one of the ways to change.
You led off with the demand control aspect of it. And that's, again, it seems to me that's probably more complex or more layered than just, well, we'll cut back somehow. We'll try to conserve. That doesn't quite do it, I imagine.
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, going to, again, someone who's fighting a war and saying, turn off the lights, it may not be persuasive. But if what you say is, we're going to give you the tools to use energy better and differently, and that means someone doesn't have to put his or her life at risk to bring you that gallon of fuel, then that makes sense to people. And one of my favorite stories about this is coming from the Marine Corps, which has been really a leader in these efforts. They had a group of new energy technologies, a lot of them energy efficiency, so cutting the demand, that they were field testing at 29 Palms out in California with young Marines. And they said, look, we're going to give you a meter here. And see that red line on your meter? If you stay below that red line and how much power you need for your computers and your other gear, then you're not going to turn on the generator. You'll be powering all of your equipment off solar panels we've got outside, and because your tent is insulated and all of that. They said, you know, do what you got to do for your mission, for your training objectives. But if you go over that red line, you're going to turn on a generator. Now, these young Marines had all been deployed, and they know that that means you're next to a loud generator that someone has to bring you fuel for, that you have to babysit, that smells, you know, all of those things, that it's an operational constraint for them and a nuisance. They stay below the line. Mm-hmm. So if we give them the tools to use less fuel to get their mission done, they use less fuel to get the mission done.
And that kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier. A lot of this seems to me, well, not a lot, but there's an element here of just presenting the information in such a way that it is meaningful to someone, that in the context that they're thinking about, talking to them in their language, I suppose.
You're absolutely right, because I think if we just come in and say energy security or energy efficiency or new energy supplies, renewable energy, are automatically a good thing. There's a lot of good things in the world. But when you come in and say, you're here to get a job done, and it's a hard job to do, and we're trying to give you the best tools. And this is going to help you get your job done, get it done better, lower the risk, lower the cost. That makes sense. And that's really, I think, our central challenge is not just to improve energy security, but to find a way to make energy innovation improve the defense mission.
You talked about something in the second piece, in the diversification piece, that I want to follow up on when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest today is Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
You can do more with less. Government CIOs and other IT executives rely on Sprint to help stretch their technology dollars. Sprint offers a powerful network for connectivity virtually anywhere, plus advanced wireless solutions designed to help you manage resources effectively. Use Sprint to help get more work done. To learn more, visit Sprint.com/federalgovernment. That's Sprint.com/federalgovernment. Coverage not available everywhere. Restrictions apply.
Constantly hearing do more with less, but wondering how? Integrity Management Consulting's acquisition and program management experts help set priorities and create efficiencies while adapting to changing requirements. Integrity will help your agency save time with innovative acquisition and program management strategies. Choose a committed partner with a proven track record. Get more done. Start with Integrity. Learn more at consultwithintegrity.com.
At BAE Systems, we realize it's critical that our armed forces can get the job done, even when budgets are tight. That's why our engineers created the technology to transform an unguided munition into a precision laser-guided rocket, the perfect low-cost surgical strike solution. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day, so we'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
It's not always easy being a dad.
When's the fairy princess coming?
Any minute now.
What? What do you mean she's not coming?
But it's always worth it.
It's the fairy princess!
It is I!
Grooms! Zinkelbell! Yay!
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life.
I know it's really you, Drew. I'm just pretending for the other kids.
Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4-DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The year was 1933, and a 23-year-old engineer named Kelly Johnson was feeling the heat. His bosses at Lockheed Aircraft were betting the future of the company on a new plane, the first to be outfitted with twin engines. What was keeping Johnson up at night was his concern about the stability of the design and what to do about it. Now, after 70 tests in a wind tunnel, he had the answer. Something no one had tried before. Kelly Johnson's twin tail concept for the Model 10 Electra not only stabilized the plane, but also helped usher in a new era in aviation technology. In less than a decade, a Model 12 was flying missions over North Africa, and a Model 14 had flown around the world in record time. The all-metal twin-engine Electra was flying high, and so was Lockheed Aircraft. The Electra story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Female veterans are more likely to be unemployed or divorced or raising kids alone than their male counterparts. I'm Emily Kopp. On Thursday's Federal Drive, the Labor Department has a new plan to help. And we'll meet Lieutenant Commander Victor Glover. He's going from Washington to outer space as one of the newest NASA astronauts. It starts at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, Sharon Burke, is my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. You mentioned a term in the first part of our conversation that I want to come back to when you were talking about diversifying the energy supply in the Defense Department, and that is the concept of rapid fielding. Now, for most folks from the outside looking in, that's an oxymoron when it comes to the Pentagon. How are you doing that? Under what conditions can you do it? And how do you decide this is something that's important enough that we need to kind of buck the rules or follow this alternative set of rules?
The department has really struggled with that, or focused on it maybe is a fairer word, in these wars, figuring out how to get the best technology into the hands of the people who need it the most. And we're also looking at how to reform the acquisition process to make sure that it can be more responsive when we need it to be. But specifically for the energy technologies that we have seen successfully put into the field in Afghanistan and Iraq, two of the organizations that have been really helpful in that are in the Marine Corps and the Army. And they've developed a process for rapid fielding. In the Marine Corps, it's called the XFOB, or the Experimental Forward Operating Base. And Colonel Charette was the head of that effort. And what he did was he identified a suite of expeditionary energy improvements that would help Marines that were forward deployed. And that included better shelters, so better tents, basically, that have insulation in them, LED lights for those tents, because lights, you wouldn't believe how much fuel those consume through a generator. And then the generator itself. The generators that they were looking at are much more efficient, and also the heating and cooling units. They looked at solar panels and then also flexible solar panels that the Marines could carry that would recharge their batteries. And they tested this, as I said earlier, at 29 Palms with Marines to make sure that it was going to wash with the Marines that were going to carry it. And they deployed it forward with the India 3-5 company that was in some of the heaviest fighting in the in Afghanistan, in the region, the southwestern region. And this equipment was proven out, and in fact, other companies were asking where they could get some, and the Marine Corps has now made it a program of record. So these things are now going to be available more broadly in the Marine Corps. Similar case with the Army, the Rapid Equipping Force. Colonel Pete Newell just retired from running that. They looked at – they're an outfit that the Army formed specifically to go out to deployed forces and try to bridge that gap between – what they need and what we can deliver in terms of equipment. And the Rapid Equipping Force has had a whole effort called Operation Dynamo that they engaged in with some of the acquisition program managers to really speed some new technologies. I think that now they've hit 50 different bases in Afghanistan with improved generators, even just looking at how were these generators laid down, was the equipment working, that they just fixed and right-sized the equipment. They brought in new, more efficient generators. They also looked at the shelters, brought in new shelters, and you know, that were better insulated. So one of the greatest things they brought also was an energy advisor at the brigade level, so who was able to go out and actually not only make sure that all these changes were being executed, but that they were being supported. Mm-hmm. So there have been some rapid fielding efforts like that that have really made a difference.
You've used the word generator about 1,000 times already in our conversation. And so my takeaway from that is that this is kind of an axis around which all of these deployments rotate, and that this is something that you're spending a lot of time and a lot of, pardon the pun, energy thinking about, and trying to find ways to really cut where you can without affecting operational capability.
I think if you think of it in terms of key pieces of equipment that enable, you know, pretty much any military mission, that use energy, I would put it in four categories. There's at the warrior level or the individual, and there we're often looking at batteries, or the things that consume batteries, so your radio, your GPS unit. Then the next level up is a contingency base, and we have had hundreds of contingency bases in Afghanistan. And the signal, the big piece of equipment, I mean, I actually think of contingency bases as what we would call a platform, the same way that we talk about a ship or a combat vehicle. As a platform, one of the key pieces of equipment is the generator. Mm-hmm. Because any power they're going to consume on that contingency base, whether it's for an operations center or a kitchen, is going to be provided by a generator that's fueled by diesel fuel. Sometimes, like at Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan, that's 50 megawatts of capacity, which is a small city. That's a lot of power that's coming through a generator. So the generators are really important. And then, you know, the next echelon up of energy consumers is where most of our consumption is, which is in big movers, aircraft, ships, combat vehicles. And then the fourth category that we can talk about if you want to is just wholly different kinds of systems. So, for example, unmanned systems, where their energy footprint is very different from anything else. And if you look at unmanned systems compared to the systems they're replacing, they often use orders of magnitude less energy per mission, but also they have more flexibility in kinds of energy. So we're looking at fuel cells, solar panels, a wide range of possibilities there.
Well, being about a 9 or 10 year old boy at heart, I like the big hulking pieces of equipment. So maybe we can talk about those when we come back from that list that you just discussed. We'll talk a little bit about the movers and some of the ways that you're working on energy consumption there. When we come back, my guest is Sharon Burke. She's Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy and Energy Plans and Programs. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back.
This week's Experts in Health topic is Benefits of Walking, featuring Dr. Mack, an internal medicine provider with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, who practices at Kaiser Permanente's Towson Medical Center.
Walk for your health. Exercising benefits your entire body. If you're thinking about starting a fitness routine, walking's a great way to start. Walking for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, boosts your health. It's good for your heart, muscles, and bones. It reduces your risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, reduces abdominal obesity, burns almost as many calories as running at a moderate pace, boosts metabolism, is gentle on your joints. Personally, it helps me relax and decreases my stress. Most importantly, walking can be sustained. Walking daily is an exercise pattern that is simple enough to continue for many years, helping to maintain a healthy weight over the long term.
For more information, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
Researchers are engineering ways to control individual cells in our nervous system, and the potential applications are mind-boggling. Using gene therapy techniques, specific brain and nerve cells can be equipped with light-sensitive molecules. Ed Boyden, a bioengineer at MIT, says they serve as switches.
Well, what we've been able to do now is to turn on and off different cells in the brain using light.
Boyden says new fiber optics can deliver complex 3D light patterns in the brain and elsewhere in the body. So these methods could block chronic pain, stop seizures, reactivate damaged nerve pathways, and more.
Now we can try to play back complex neural codes, like the kind that might represent a visual scene or a decision directly to the brain.
Yes, someday, maybe even literally putting thoughts in people's minds. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Life is filled with uncertainty, military life especially. AFMA can help you breathe easy through it all. Since 1879, AFMA has helped military families with low-cost military life insurance and the best survivor assistance. We're experts at helping you manage the complexities of military life and securing your family's financial well-being. Call 1-877-398-2263 today or go to AAFMAA.com to see how we can help you.
The Hurricane Getaway Plan. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Having a getaway plan can save your life, and during hurricane season, you should be ready to evacuate, have a supply of water and non-perishable food, have cash in case banks and ATMs aren't available, have a backup supply of meds and a copy of your prescriptions. Learn the best evacuation routes from places you and your family go every day. Dr. Nicole Lurie is HHS's Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response.
Follow the instructions of your local emergency officials. If they recommend evacuating, do it. It can save your life.
Your family should know where to meet up and how to get there. And you should include your pet's needs in the plans.
Make a plan for your animals, too. It includes pet food and a leash if one is necessary.
Learn more at phe.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
The second annual Multiple Award Government and Industry Conference will bring together federal acquisition thought leaders to discuss the changing landscape of GWACs and MACs, from new vehicles like Oasis and Megamax like Eagle to the expanding federal strategic sourcing initiative. Join them July 10th to the 12th for MAGIC 2013 and hear from NASA, HHS, DHS, SBA, GSA, DOD, and the Hill as they provide insight on using these contracts to acquire the latest technologies. Register today at magicgov.org.
We're back on In Depth with Frances Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Sharon Burke is my guest. She's Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs at the Defense Department. And you gave me four categories in our last segment of kind of where the energy usages fall. The one that I like the most, because I like big stuff that goes bang, is the movers category. And you're talking there about the things that move other things, not just people, but equipment as well. I've covered on this program on occasion the Great Green Fleet that the Navy is doing and some other projects like that. Tell me about a few of those ways that you're starting to see a difference being made in any of these categories, use, diversity of supply, and security.
Sure. And it's really interesting because in terms of high volume, those are our high volume consumers, the cargo aircraft and the destroyers and combat vehicles. So if you're going to figure out how to give your force a lighter footprint on the battlefield or at sea, then you have to address that use. What we were talking about before is important too, because that's about criticality, right? That's the pointy edge, you know, the pointy end of the sword where people are really fighting, where even small changes make big differences. But for the big volume consumers, we've seen a variety of kinds of changes that have really made a difference. And they may be significant big changes, like the Navy, as part of their efforts that you mentioned, has the USS Macon Island, which has a hybrid electric drive added into it. And they said just from their first deployment, I believe they had $20 million in fuel savings. And over its lifetime, they expect something like $250 million in fuel savings. But even beyond the monetary savings, which, of course, matters to us very much, are you talking about a ship that can be at sea longer, right? That has a longer period of time before it needs to be refueled? Because that's a tactical advantage, and particularly as we're looking at the future where we're going to be deployed more in the Asia-Pacific region, and it's a long way away, and it takes a lot of fuel to get there and stay there. Something like hybrid electric drive offers a lot of very interesting possibilities. Another one is the new tanker aircraft, the KC-46, that will be replacing some airplanes that are 40, 50 years old or more. It was in the contract for that aircraft that it be more energy efficient, and that the vendor that won the contract was not only was it going to be a criterion in winning the contract, you're going to be held to it. So that's another way that we get at better performance. Some of the biggest consumers for the Air Force are the mobility aircraft or the strategic lift or cargo aircraft. And that would be like a C-130, C-5, C-17. And as you said, these are the really big aircraft that move things and move people and that the rest of the force depends on. It really is one of our comparative advantages as a military that we can get anywhere with anything. Some of the changes that Air Mobility Command and Transportation Command have put into place have to do with things that don't sound all that exciting. They're about different routing, different loading, flight profiles. And these are things that the commercial sector has been doing for a long time. And I think just in their first outing with that, they identified something like $500 million in savings just from routing differently. So with those big aircraft, a little change goes a long way, and we're looking at some other things in that area too. And this is true for destroyers at sea, for combat vehicles, if you're talking about things like lighter weight materials, or you're even sometimes new paints, certainly on ships, you can save 1% or 2% of your energy burn just with new hull coatings, mm-hmm. which, again, doesn't sound that all that exciting, you know. Talk about the big movers, new paint maybe doesn't really thrill you, but it does save a lot of fuel. And again, if the end result of that is that we have a ship that can be at sea longer, then that's a really strong tactical operational benefit for us.
That those things, though, although you're right, they don't sound as sexy as some other things, to me are the most interesting because they require, first of all, they require really entrepreneurial thought, which a lot of folks, I think, have the misconception that a government operation, not just DOD, but a government operation in general, doesn't do. That's not their strong suit. And the other is scale. I mean, when you go 1% of something, if we save 1%, you know, if I save 1% on my electricity bill at home, maybe I'm going to be able to go to McDonald's an extra day that year. But 1% on operations of an entire branch of the military or an entire category of operations, that's a whole lot of money. And that gets us up to the kind of numbers we've been talking about in some of the budget issues that the Pentagon's having.
Well, if you consider our fuel bill, you know, our total energy bill annually is about $20 billion. So we spent about $15 billion on petroleum last year. And, you know, that was maybe between 4 and 5 billion gallons. So scale in this case, you are talking about a lot of money and a lot of fuel. And again, you're talking about a lot of distance, particularly as the department is focusing more on the future and on the Asia Pacific region and those really long lines of communication and having to project presence and power and all of that. Scale also of, you know, just the distance is going to be a factor, and all of that adds up to a lot fast.
The kind of go back to what we talked about earlier about culture here too, though, because you're asking people to think along the lines of, well, would this be as functional, this widget, whatever it is, if we made it out of a different kind of material that's lighter? Or could we go a different direction? Is the whole routing thing is what that sounds like to me. If we go this way, can we take advantage of whatever? How difficult is that to ask folks and get them to respond to the idea of doing things or just thinking, looking at things a little differently than they're used to?
I think that's one of the signal challenges for an office like mine, especially a new office coming into a very mature bureaucracy, is to figure out, it's not so much to walk into, you know, the chief of staff of the Air Force and say, your culture is wrong and you need to change it, but more to figure out, how do you use their culture, harness it to make this kind of change? So where do they have an interest? So, for example, if they're looking at new missions and new aircraft, they need it to have things like range and endurance. They'll value things like low signature, right? It's not as you can't pick it up on radar as easily. They'll value things like loiter time. How long can it stay? To me, those are all energy functions, or certainly energy affects how much range and endurance you have. So the question is, how can we take what they need to do and what they want to do and show them that their energy use is going to affect that? And, you know, we have to convince them, the burden's on me to convince them that there's a military capability and benefit here. But we also have some sticks along with the carrots. I do put funding into play to try to help achieve that kind of culture change or rationalization of the culture, maybe. But also I have some other things that I do. So, for example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has added a key performance parameter that's mandatory for energy performance. So now all of the military departments are required to look at the energy performance of their systems. And it's exactly what you're talking about, which is not so much to tell them, you have to value energy performance more than you value lethality of this system, but more to say, you need to know what the energy performance is getting you in terms of capability and what it's costing you. What kind of burden it's putting on your force, and then you can have a value to it. Then you know if it's worth it to you to invest in lighter weight materials. If they don't know and they don't do that kind of analysis, then they can't answer that question, and then we get what we get when we go forward.
You laid a big number on the table a few minutes ago, and when we come back, I'd like to bat that number around with you a little bit. Sharon Burke is my guest. She's the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs at the Pentagon, and we'll continue in just a minute on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
recently on Federal News Radio's Federal Tech Talk, sponsored by AT&T.
We are speaking with Phil Kemmelor, Senior Manager, Enterprise Intelligence, Digital Analytics at Ernst & Young, and we're talking about digital analytics for federal agencies.
Now the idea of engagement around content is important, and especially on government websites. You know, you're not buying anything, but you're looking at the kinds of tasks people are completing. Those are the kinds of things to measure and really understand. Do they have the desired effect?
Secure Mobile Government is here.
Evaluate a department budget at a metro station.
You can now work out in the field with a smartphone and the safety and security of the AT&T network. AT&T extends the cyber defense perimeter of your agency's mobile workforce.
Study new employment stats while teleworking.
Your security is predictive and preventive. Go to att.com/gov/secure to learn how AT&T mobile security can safely connect you to both your agency and constituents. AT&T, rethink possible.
Hamid Jafari eradicated polio in India. John McKinnon rescued 160 victims of child pornography. And Kevin Geis saved the Air Force $1 billion in energy costs. The list of federal employees making a real difference goes on and on. 31 individuals and teams of feds are being recognized for their work. Each has been named a Service to America Medal finalist. Hear interviews with each of the nominees and learn more about what makes them tick at federalnewsradio.com. Search Service to America.
If you know someone who's done something outstanding in the field of human capital management, nominate them for Federal News Radio's 4th Annual COSI Awards. Help us call attention to best practices in your office and government-wide. You can nominate anyone, career, political, or a contractor working in the HR field. The award is named after Federal News Radio senior correspondent Mike COSI and his lifelong dedication to the reporting of management and federal pay and benefits issues. To nominate someone for the COSI Awards, go to federalnewsradio.com, search COSI Award.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Your DOD report brought to you every weekday afternoon at 40 minutes after the hour by BAE Systems. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Sharon Burke. She's the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs. And the number you laid on the table a few minutes ago is $20 billion in energy use. And tell me what that $20 billion consists of before we go any further there.
I'm glad you asked, because I should have made a distinction up front. There's two basic categories of energy use in the Department of Defense. One is operational, and the other is installations. So the $15 billion, a little more than $15 billion, is in the operational side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the energy we use to support military operations. Definition of the law says the energy used to train, sustain, and field military forces. The other $4 billion or so is for installations. And that's actually not directly in my portfolio. My colleague, John Conger, who's the acting deputy undersecretary of defense for installations, he oversees that kind of energy use. But that's the energy we use in buildings. So for lighting, heating, and cooling. And it's very close to the way the commercial sector does. So mostly our bases in the United States and around the world, it's the bases and the facilities energy use. Mm-hmm. There is an interesting angle to that that is operational in nature that we work very closely on, which is we support a lot of operations out of our bases these days. So their energy supply, their electricity supply, and the security of that supply is very important.
Mm-hmm. So that number, you said $15 billion of that is petroleum. That means $5 billion comes from other sources. I imagine that's primarily electricity, but as we talked about earlier, with alternative and renewables starting to become more common in the portfolio, that number's on the increase, I would think.
Yes, the $4 to $5 billion that's in installations is electricity. You're correct. And the interesting thing about that is that the Department of Defense in the United States is almost completely, like 99% reliant on the electric grid, the commercial electric grid. So we use commercial power providers for that. We do, however, have lots of different arrangements, power purchasing agreements, energy savings performance contracts that do allow us to incorporate renewable energy into our bases. And John Conger's oversight there includes a goal, I think, of all the military departments to go to 3 gigawatts of renewable energy. So, again, we have many tools for using that. The good news is that is generally third-party finance. That is not taxpayer dollars. That's where we're using what the base needs and what the base has to attract third-party financing.
Catherine Hammock from the Army talked a lot about some of those provisions that they're doing when she was on the program last week. That program's archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Where do you expect to see that trend go in the coming years? Do you expect to see – I mean, you've said one of the stated goals is to get away from petroleum where you can, where it's appropriate. How do you expect to see that play out?
Well, I have to be clear that we do expect that we will continue to be a very petroleum dependent force. Petroleum has an energy density and a universal availability that's very, very important for a military force. So over the Future Year Defense Program, I think the last numbers we saw, and I don't know what they're affected for, how sequester might affect the number, but you know, we're planning to buy something like $52 billion worth of petroleum. So we're going to continue to be buying petroleum for some time to come. And, you know, we have equipment in our arsenal that's designed to use liquid fuels that's going to be around for many decades. So that supply will continue. So that's one trend. But I also, now that we've had energy performance and really energy diversity added into the requirements process, and it's also in the acquisition process, I do expect that we will see energy efficiency, performance improvements, and sometimes things like lighter weight materials that might not directly sound like an energy innovation, but they are. They dramatically affect your energy performance. But then also tactical solar, fuel cells, better batteries, and better ways of using batteries, all of those things. We expect to see those things coming into the arsenal. And specifically, my office has a really interesting budget authority called certification, where I'm one of two offices in the Pentagon that certifies the president's budget for how well it's doing. And we are tracking about $1.6 billion in fiscal year 13 in energy improvements that the departments are investing. We don't know yet how sequester is going to affect that, because it affects everything. But that's what we're tracking right now, and I think about $8 billion over the Future Year Defense Program.
You mentioned sequester, and that brings me to a broader point that we'll use to finish up this part of the conversation, and that is, what is that process like where you're trying to manage this 800-pound gorilla on a daily basis that was not of your doing and was not of your wish? But there it is, and you've got to figure out not just how to get to September 30th, but how to get to October 1st of this year and the year after and the year after.
It's not easy, and I think as a manager in the department, the hardest thing by far is the toll it takes on your people, and the fact that I have to furlough my staff very soon is, for me, heartbreaking, because they work really hard and they do a good job, and they don't deserve that. So on a personal level, I find the sequester a painful experience. I'm very worried about what it means for the force, and certainly in my area, but across the board, about our readiness. And I think readiness is a slippery concept for the public. You know, what does that actually mean? You know, is it bigger than a bread box?
Mm-hmm.
It is, because it means that whatever you expect us to do, whether it's helping to put out wildfires in Colorado or defending the country against an attack from another country or a non-state actor, we need forces that are ready to do that. And I worry that sequester is going to affect readiness in a way that's going to become apparent at the worst possible time. Energy is a part of that, and that's one of the reasons it's hard for us to know exactly how our programs are going to be affected, because some of these investments are implicit. So, you know, I mentioned the C-130. Big aircraft consumes a lot of fuel. There's a modernization program for it. If they have to trim back that program, it may include some of the energy performance upgrades. We just don't know yet. But it's not good news for anybody if this key program, this key aircraft that everyone depends on, has its modernization program cut. So some of these impacts are going to take us a little while to understand. And that does make day-to-day business harder. But at the end of the day, it's such an important mission, and certainly having talked to the folks in Afghanistan this morning, you don't let yourself forget what you're really there for. So it's pain, It's painful on a personal level when you have to tell people to go home. But I don't think anyone in my office or in any of the offices we work with forgets why they're really there.
Sharon Burke is my guest. She's the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs. And I want to talk about innovation and what that means in your portfolio when we come back to wrap up on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Your DOD report every weekday afternoon at 40 minutes after the hour, brought to you by BAE Systems. Pentagon Solutions continues in just a moment.
Is brought to you by CenturyLink.
Greg Garcia is the director of the Army IT Agency. He says ITA's virtualized desktop initiative pilot demonstrates the potential to improve security and make data more accessible.
Right now I have a little cube on my desk that basically has the network connection and outlet for the keyboard and outlet for the CAC reader and speakers. All the intelligence is in the cloud.
Listen to Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Let's get down to brass tacks. There's nothing more important than trust. CenturyLink offers cybersecurity solutions to the government, and the Department of Homeland Security has approved CenturyLink to provide enhanced cybersecurity services to critical infrastructure entities to keep you efficient and secure. As your trusted technology partner, their visionary cloud infrastructure, global broadband network, along with custom communication solutions and response dedicated support, provide the scalable solutions you need 24/7, 365. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
European authorities are investigating two men of Tunisian origin that are suspected of planning to use model airplanes for terrorist attacks. Prosecutors in Germany say police there and in Belgium raided a series of sites for evidence of possible attack plans and preparations. Raids were carried out in Stuttgart, Munich, and Saxony in eastern Germany. The two men under suspicion are studying aeronautics at the University of Stuttgart. I'm G.G. Green.
Meet Cameron Ballard, Marine Corps veteran and EADS North America employee building the Lakota helicopter for the U.S. Army.
The United States military really taught me a sense of pride, ownership. I brought that along with me here. I work on the Lakota. It's a great helicopter. Try to put a little bit of me in every helicopter. It's an American-built machine. We're putting it out to the United States military. I do take a great deal of pride in the fact that we're on time, on budget with every aircraft.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Come see high-profile D.C. politicos face off on the tennis court in the second annual Washington Castles Charity Classic, Thursday, July 18th. Members of Congress and administration officials join local celebrities and some of the world's best tennis players, including Martina Hingis, in a bipartisan World Team Tennis Format match with 100% of ticket proceeds benefiting charity. For more information, visit WashingtonCastles.com or call 202-4TENNIS.
The second annual Multiple Award Government and Industry Conference will bring together federal acquisition thought leaders to discuss the changing landscape of GWACs and MACs, from new vehicles like Oasis and Megamacs like Eagle to the expanding Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative. Join them July 10th to the 12th for MAGIC 2013 and hear from NASA, HHS, DHS, SBA, GSA, DOD, and the Hill as they provide insight on using these contracts to acquire the latest technologies. Register today at magicgov.org.
All of Federal News Radio's exclusive interviews and shows are archived online at federalnewsradio.com. Listen to an interview again or share it with friends. Find it at federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs. And one of the things that you've spoken about at a number of the events at which you speak has been the concept of innovation. I talk to leaders in industry all the time, and agencies are telling them we want to see something innovative. And the definition of that is elusive sometimes. Is it even definable, or do you just know it when you see it?
Innovation, I think, is definable. And I would turn it around and say it's less which technology do I love the most and where do I think – and I get that question a lot, by the way. They'll say, which energy technology do you think is most promising for the military? And I'd say all my children are beautiful. I love all the energy technologies. But seriously, it's more what do we need to be able to do? Mm-hmm. And you have to let what the requirement is drive the innovation. So, for example, with those contingency bases, they're in remote areas where they're hard to resupply, and they've got a lot of communications gear that requires a consistency in their energy supply. That's a need. So what technologies can help us meet that need? And we've been looking at tactical solar, but we've also been looking at fuel cells, even flywheels. We've been looking at a range of technologies that can help us get what we need for that particular requirement. So the real challenge for us is, what does the Department of Defense need? What do our armed forces need to be able to do? And what are the energy innovations that are going to help them do it better, do it differently, you know, do it at greater distance? And we have done a lot of collaboration with the Department of Energy, where what we're doing is we're bringing our warfighter requirements and they're bringing their energy expertise, and we're exploring where that overlap is. So there's a big range of energy technologies in there, energy storage, tactical solar, you name it, where I think it can help us meet our needs.
We've talked about a number of different technologies and a number of different ways that you're applying them throughout the course of the hour. We're almost out of time. But I guess if you were going to sum up in just a couple of thoughts what it is you would like to see your office do moving forward, and we'll hopefully use that as the kind of the framework for the next time we have a conversation like this, ma'am.
Well, what I hope we're doing is that we're laying in the understanding that better energy security means a better military force and more capable military force today and for the long term, particularly as we look at the vulnerabilities we've seen or in our force in Afghanistan and Iraq, that they've been attacked on their supply lines and we've had to put more protection on them than we wanted to. What that's going to mean for the future. And I hope that what we're doing is we're not only showing them that that's important, but that it's solvable and that we can do that. And that right now the energy sector in the United States is going through so many changes with oil and gas coming online and the geopolitical influence. What can we do to take advantage of that?
It's been great to have you here, and I would love to have you come back and continue this conversation.
Anytime.
Thank you very much. Sharon Burke is Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs at the Pentagon. My guest for the hour on Pentagon Solutions on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Programs archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number two is coming in a moment.